Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 146, How to Save the World, Protest, Reform, and Revolutions.
Well, you know, Jesus is saving the world, you know what I mean? And Buddha is saving the world. And it saves itself all the time, you know? So I think people have to really save themselves, don't you think? Like Dalai Lama always says, world peace through inner peace. And I think that still remains the watchword. Isabel Losada also had a good slogan, I think, who wrote that English book from Tibet with for Tibet with love. But then they made a mistitle of it here in the U.S. Some stupid thing, How to Save the World, actually. Stupid title. Because they didn't want to put Tibet in there, you know. Some American publisher, you know. But anyway, her slogan is quite good. It says, think globally, act joyfully. I think that's a really good one. So I think the main thing is to be happy, you know, and forget about saving the world. Why save the world? Let it blow up. Who gives a damn? People will be reborn somewhere else, and if they have to blow it up one more time, they have blown it up millions of times. If they have to blow it up another time, then they'll go through the whole freak out all together, like Obi-Wan Kenobi shuddering in the movement of the Force, as they create a new world, which they'll then live on, and then hopefully not blow that one up. But of course, I don't believe that the Avalokiteshvara and Vajrapani and the Sphere Hayagriva, they're going to allow them to do it. I have actually seen it, where they didn't allow them to do it. They would have done it in Nixon's time otherwise. In Brezhnev's time, they were planning to. And so they won't be allowed to blow it up, you know. So the main thing is everybody should become joyful, aware of the nature of reality, themselves, and then they will see the world being saved by enlightened beings, and then they will become enlightened beings, and that will add to the saving. Do you know what I mean? So the idea of objectifying a world out there that has to be saved is a huge mistake. Because it puts the people who are trying to save it into the same almost materialistic game of the people who are trying to dominate it and who are destroying themselves and the world, are running after some sort of outer objective thing as if that would help them. And that they'll be happy when I'm rich and famous and I'm a big shot in Hollywood. Ha, ha, ha. You'll just have a higher grade of Prozac when that happens. You won't be happier, not at all. Only be happy when you're happy with what you are and what you have and what there is, right? So that's the key thing, don't you think? So how to save the world, I don't know about the title. But it's good. It's good. We all want to save the world, you know. The solution, the Dalai Lama, okay, my book, his act of truth, you see. But I don't say that he's the solution for the world. I say his act of truth is the solution. You know what the act of truth is? It underlies Gandhi's idea of satyagraha, and it means, I guess satyakarma or something like that. It would have been in ancient time. Actually, I'm not sure what the Sanskrit term they use, but I think satyakarma. And it means that whatever the external situation seems to be, one acts according to the truth, even if it seems to be impossible or it makes you weaker or whatever. And then there's the famous story about the courtesan who confronted the Emperor Ashoka over something in Patna, and I can't remember what it was. And she said, if what I'm saying is the truth, let the Ganges flow backwards, so you, your majesty, will see. And then the Ganges turned backwards, and far from the ocean, couldn't have a tide as high up as Patna, you know? It's hundreds of miles upstream, you know? And the other famous one is the King of Shibi. You know the story of the King of Shibi? King of Shibi was a previous life of the Buddha. It's a Jataka story. And blind beggar, who probably was incarnation of Indra usually in that case, but I can't remember, came in and said, and he was very famous, he had beautiful blue eyes, very famous for them, and said, I've heard you have the best eyes in the kingdom, and I want those eyes. I'm blind, and I've heard you're very generous. Please give me your eyes. So the king of Sheba was like, fantastic! Someone asked me something really difficult. I love it. Okay, call the surgeons. You're going to have them. And then all the queens are weeping, and the ministers are freaking out. Blind king, the country will go to ruin, the thieves will come, the enemies will never know what to do. You can't do this, your majesty, you are to the kingdom. No, what are you talking about? I'm going to do it. I can run the kingdom fine, blind. You'll be my friend and help me. I'm going to give my eyes. This is a great culmination of my life. You don't realize this is the best thing that could happen to me. Calls in the surgeons. They're all freaking out. He then says, don't give me anesthetic. I don't want to be out, unconscious, and then you mess it up and then tell me you couldn't do it. I want to be awake for the whole thing. And so they took out his eyes and they transplanted them into the other guy, and people are still having a spaz, you know. So finally he says, okay, you people have not believed me. If it is true that it is the greatest joy of my existence to give my eyes to this blind beggar, then may my eyes be restored. So you people will be happy too. And bam, his eyes were back and the beggar was also seeing. So that's the act of truth. I mean, it accomplishes the miraculous, the impossible, based on truth, even as people find it unbelievable. So the truth that people find unbelievable about the Dalai Lama is what he has said since 1988, that the nonviolence is the way of the 21st century. We will not be having these wars. They are a mistake. They're just a carryover, a spillover from the idiot Bushes and the idiot Cheneys and the Halliburtons and the whole dumb business. From the century of the superpowers, and that from the century of the imperialists, you know. And superpowers are just what I call not quite post-colonialists. And they say they're post-colonialists, but in fact they're not. And we're going to have a century of dialogue, and nonviolence is going to be the power. Nonviolence will rule. And that's the truth. And therefore he really liberating Tibet by refusing to fight. In a violent way, refusing to hate the rulers of China. Even his own people, when they go overboard and scream too roughly, he says, no, that's not working. And actually, if you look at the Tibet movement in America, for years I have gone to the protests here in Tibet, here in New York or there in New York or everywhere. And then the Tibetans, you know, Tibet for Tibetans and all that, that's okay. But then they get very hepped up and they get more bloody, their T-shirts, and they go, China out of Tibet and shame on China. And so because they do overflow emotionally like that, and they threw a couple of rocks, I mean, people say they all threw rocks, but they didn't, just one or two at the Chinese embassy. But because of that, they have not in 25 years, 35 years I've been going there for their March 10th demonstration, they have not basically persuaded the Chinese American community in the United States, which is a powerful multi-million person community, which would really give them the clout that they need, both with China and with the U.S., they have not gotten them on board because the Chinese think they're against them and they're anti-China, which actually the Tibet movement is pro-China. So save the world, this is the key thing, is like, let go of the world. Let it go. We're going to be happy, whatever, you know. And with happiness, we'll do everything we can to help others. But we're not going to get angry if we see someone destroying the world. We're going to feel sorry for them. Because we're going to realize that our life is beyond this world. We are not quite, you said transcendent nation, that's better. The nation transcends any particular life. It's a multi-life, infinite entanglement. And let's give up the world, actually. We'll save it by giving it up. Every day you present the mandala offering, what it's called. In the mandala offering, you offer Mount Meru and the four continents and all the living beings and yourself. And all your property and possessions, and you offer it to the enlightened beings, because the unenlightened ones can't take care of it. They mess it up. They constantly destroy it and themselves. So the enlightened beings have to take care of it, you know. Well, yeah, sometimes, you know, there are six paramitas, and they're all to develop ourselves. But the first three totally involve interacting with others. So you need others. You can't give gifts to yourself. Well, you can, but it's better to be able to give to others, or to be ready to give everything to others. You can't bear injury from yourself. Others have to injure you for you to be non-vengeful and non-angry. And then being righteous and justice, you know, being just and moral and ethical in Shila, you know, those first three, Dana, Shila, Kshanti. And you can't be moral except with another, you know. So other beings are Buddhas for us, you know, as they say, you know, the Buddha is happy when we treat other beings as if they were Buddhas. Jesus said that too. You see me in the least of these, and that way you are you're worshiping me, you know, rather than I'm so great and never mind those other people. So developing ourselves involves developing other people. So it's not really a dichotomy. Do you know what I mean? Wisdom and meditation one needs, and that, so it's not just staying sticking with ourselves. In other words, if you protest downtown somewhere in a joyful manner, and if you're ready to embrace the foe, and that's your protest, then you can march and protest. But if you find yourself getting angry, if you find yourself getting vengeful, wanting to throw rocks and so forth, or wanting to hit back if they hit you, then you better go back on retreat, sort of thing, right? Because then you don't have the, you can't muster the nonviolent warrior energy yet. You know, you're not ready. So you can't act joyfully. In other words, you're going to get unhappy, you know? So then you better go be unhappy by yourself so you don't make someone else unhappy. And there's a difference between trying to make a different world by taking for real the situation of being in the imperfect world versus discovering how it is by removing the veils of ignorance that prevent one from seeing it. So the one is, both work, both kind of ways of approaching it work. But I think the latter is more powerful in a way because it's sort of more encouraging. It's like you're uncovering reality rather than making another reality, you know, which seems can seem impossible more easily. I mean, it can also seem impossible to how can we see this couch as nirvana and this moment here in this room as being in nirvana? How can we do that? That also seems rather difficult sometimes when we think we should be like doing something and then going somewhere else to get to nirvana, you know. But actually, here is nirvana, is what how we're supposed to experience being here. So that also is difficult, but it's a different kind of difficulty, maybe, than making this into nirvana, you know. Cause vehicle, they, you know, they call it cause vehicle and effect vehicle. And there is a difference between cause and effect vehicle just in the sutra system. You don't have to resort to tantra necessarily for that. You know, the Akshaya Mati Nirdesha spells that out in an exoteric sutra. So you don't need, you know, the esoteric idea necessarily. But esoteric idea moves more powerfully in that direction, of course. The world is engaged in a worldwide tantra in the sense that, you know, people's world picture dominates how they experience the world. And therefore cultures create a matrix within which people experience the world. And therefore the battle over how cultures are structured is a big one. For example, when Buddhism first went to China, the Confucian ministers were very freaked out by a number of things. But one of them was, don't allow the Buddhists in here, Your Majesty, advising the memorials to the emperor, because if you do, what they do is they run off to those caves and they make Monet water lily paintings in the caves of Amitabha's Pure Land, Amitofo's Pure Land. And then the peasants go in there and they see these magnificent mansions and palaces and jeweled beings and extraordinary bodhisattvas and goddesses flying in the air with offering things and so forth. And then when they come downtown and they see Your Majesty's like dinky palace with its like peeling paint and like broken shingles and like, and Your Majesty dragging yourself out of your harem looking like a shriveled wimp, although they don't say that, of course, or they'd be boiled in oil. But anyway, they will lose respect for your kingdom, where you are the mediator between heaven and earth, and they'll see heaven as something that doesn't exist in this world, and they will not be so interested in paying taxes and doing labor and, you know, following your every command. They won't be interested because they'll have this higher being that they will orient themselves toward. They'll have a world picture in which there is a greater being for their allegiance, which would be Amitofo. So don't let them in here, or they'll spoil your total control over the minds of your people. You know what I mean? They said things like that. And they also said, it would be terrible. Your Majesty will have to bow to a monk That would be horrible. You're supposed to be in heaven, and earth, you know, the mediation between heaven and earth, and now you'll be bowing to a monk? That's terrible. That's the whole problem of the Chinese Communist Party today. They're stuck in that imperial situation. They're scared witless. They don't even have the ideology of imperialism, nor do they have the skill of imperialism, where all the great emperors of China always patronized the national teacher, and they always bowed before them. The foolish ones did not. Like the Qin emperor burned Confucius's books, what they call nowadays the first emperor. The silly communists made an opera recently, and they got all those artists to work on it, and they paraded around the Metropolitan Opera with it. They called first emperor. Making like he was the great guy, you know, the Qin emperor. He was a complete nasty idiot, like Mao. And he killed millions of people, and he said, 10,000-year dynasty lasted for 15 years. When he died, then they took his brat out and threw him in the garbage heap. And then the Han Dynasty came in, where they started respecting, they dug up whatever was left of Confucius's writing. That guy burned all of Confucius's books, and Lao Tzu's books, and then there was no Buddhism at the time. So, you know, the attempt to just totally monopolize and be God to your people, while they got kind of close at different times in China with the first emperor and then with Mao, and they're still hoping they can manage that, but they can't, of course. So what's the substitute? Well, they just have to look at their own history. And their ideal national teacher is, of course, the Dalai Lama. And they bring the Dalai Lama, and the Dalai Lama is there to share his vibe, Guan Yin, that is, for the Chinese, with the Chinese people, and they'll be ecstatic. And then they'll say, well, the Communist Party is not so bad. They let us have a Dalai Lama. They didn't give us a Mercedes. They didn't give us, like, $1 million or, like, account, you know, charge accounts at Gucci's. Every peasant in China didn't get one. But and we have to work like slaves, but at least on Sunday we can go, or whatever, we can go and see the Dalai Lama and hear him teach about compassion. You know? So that's an obvious move for them. And it's too sad that they can't, I mean, they will see it. It's too sad they don't see it right away and cut the nonsense right this minute.
This week's podcast is a selection from the Bob Thurman and Tibet House U.S. member archives. To watch the full video, please visit bobthurman.com. For more free teachings from Bob Thurman, please be sure to follow Tibet House U.S. on YouTube. Video versions of classic podcasts are posted weekly. And now back to Bob.
Cheer up! Smile! Don't look so serious. That's how. This Reverend Michael Beckwith down in L.A., he blew my mind the other day. He gave this lecture, and he said about Jesus, what about all the trials and tribulations? They asked Jesus, apparently, and Jesus said, yeah, there's going to be trials and tribulations, but be of good cheer. That's like Shantideva. That's like Buddha. Think globally, act joyfully. That's the key thing. Have fun. Is that, you know, that's really what happened with the Russians, why the Russians left Eastern Europe and why they had Gorbachev and Yeltsin. And Putin is only backtracking a little bit on that because we've been behaving so badly and so aggressively, you know, the U.S. But the Russians were sick of not having fun. They love to have fun, Russians. They're like vodka, like running around, them sleighs. Did you ever visit Petersburg? You should have seen, in Petersburg, they have some kind of throne room preserved from the Nicholas and the last czars, you know, since Peter the Great built it, you know. And that throne room that makes Buckingham Palace or some French thing look sick. The Russians knew about imperial glory. You know, they really did. They had the wealth. You know, they were like in Dune, you know, the guy with the big thing and the throne room there and the weird whales floating overhead. They really knew how to be like majestic and enjoy that, you know, enjoy something. And so they got tired of this really boring, clomping around militaristic behavior. And they wanted to have more fun, you know. And I think America likes Obama because he's a little more fun. He's not all spewing fear and terror. And we certainly should be sick of the really bad TV shows that we get all the time. So since they watch it 20 hours a week on average. It's really bad. There's not any good shows. They even ruined Star Trek. They turned it into Stargate and have it all controlled by the Pentagon. At least Star Trek was going where no man had gone before and all this, you know. Kirk was out there. He was spouting the American way. But at least he had Spock, and, you know, they had some fun. Now it's the Pentagon, you know. Everything goes from the red phone to the Pentagon and to the president in the middle of traveling billions of miles into other galaxies, you know. It's like a total, like, co-optation of the science fiction. Although there's still occasionally some good shows, you know. So eventually Americans will be tired of being bored. The Chinese often say, like in the people spitting venom, who are mostly hired by the government, actually, on the internet, you know, since the recent protests around the world, you give America back to the Native Americans and go back to Germany or Norway or wherever, and we'll give Tibet back to the Tibetans. You know, once they get over pretending that they always owned it, and then when they're sort of admitting without admitting that they invaded it, they then say, well, but that's what you do. You know, you invade Hawaii, you invade this and that. But the point is, that was done by our ancestors, not by us. And we try, those liberals among us, try to pay back. And occasionally there is a big settlement to the Tlingit Indians. They open banks, you know, they have fishing fleets, although then they have to be restrained from overfishing. But, you know, here and there, we owe them trillions of dollars over the Black Hills gold that we have treaties about. We owe them most of northern New York State, which they would take better care of. Presumably, there might be some bad lumbering ones, but they might take care of it, you know. And we want to do that. It's a system of, you know, justice, the wheel of justice ever rolls, and we'll have to be, and we'll do that with the black people as well, the Native American people. It's a time of repairing. So that doesn't legitimize them creating a situation where they have to repair in some other time. It's a completely meaningless argument. So yes, the Native Americans are, although there's another thing. Native Americans have very much lost a lot of their culture, you know. Like I remember once, a famous Native American, you know, Six Nations Indian medicine man, chief medicine man, talking with some Tibetan Lama and going on and on with the rap about the white people and how stupid they were because they didn't realize that you can't own land and just taking care of it and blah, 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 you know, which is righteous, you know, righteous indignation sort of riff. And the Tibetan Lama, little thin Tibetan Lama, Rinpoche, you know, and this big fat, he was a huge fat guy, that guy. He was at least 350 pounds. He's died since then. The Indian guy was, you know, eating tip-top bread and so on, you know, on the reservation. And the Tibetan Lama guy said, yeah, that's right. It's too bad they didn't realize you can't own land. Actually, in Dharma teaching, we say, you don't even own your own body. And the Indian guy went like, ah! And then he sort of started going like, this huge bulk that was his body, and sort of thought about not owning it. And then we didn't know if we were going to have like a, he was going to decide this guy was a spy for the whites or something. He was going to freak out. And then he just roared with laughter and he let go of himself, kind of, you know, and it was great. But he needed that transcendent, that Dharma, a little bit uplift. Because again, he was stuck. It's like saving the world. Again, he was stuck in like, he has the righteous way and the others are infidels and they like, they, you know, and there has to be payback, you know, rather than happily realizing that they're stupid, yes, and he has his thing, and that what's the point, you know, and just be free in your mind, you know, and just don't put an end to the cycle of it, you know, and if you don't own it, then they didn't take it away from you, in fact, you know. If you know that it's not owned, then you don't have to fight anybody about it, even if they broke a treaty. Yes, then on a joyful level, you can show them the treaty they signed where they owe you half of New York State and a bunch of forests. But you don't get all wound up about it. It's very, very key. So there are these issues and there are these things, but, and there's middle ways in all of them, and there's negotiating with all men. Dalai Lama's not saying he wants to, like Chinese always say, oh, well, they'll make feudal theocracy again. But he's not making theory. He has proposed and worked out and elaborated and sold to his old people a whole new system in Tibet, you know, and a new way of governance, new way of living. But it will keep the important old things about the environment and about the, you know, about and about moderate industrialization. You know, the sickness of industrialization, the cancer of of uncontrolled industrialization is what how China is actually destroying itself. You know, that's another thing that came to me in writing this book, talk about microcosm. You know, China would have changed already in the late 1980s like Russia did. like South Africa did. That's when the whole world was going to change. It was at a certain moment in the life of Avalokiteshvara on this planet. And they would have changed. It isn't their stubbornness only that they didn't change. It was the U.S. It was the Bush and Scowcroft and these people telling them, go ahead, be a pain in the neck. Kill everybody in Tiananmen Square and in all the Tiananmen Squares throughout China and this. Control that people and keep that cheap labor pumping for us and build all our dirty products that we can't build here because of the environmental awareness here and break our labor unions and make us rich and we, you and we will be rich elites on top of the slaves that we will maintain on both sides. And then because of that support by us, they then supported the North Koreans, they supported the Burmese junta, they started raping Africa like they're doing now and putting in dictators wherever they can. And in a way, we are totally complicit with that. So in a way, we've inflicted them with the disease of environmentally destructive, over-greedy, over-concentrated, unbridled laissez-faire capitalism that couldn't be sustained anymore in America without a new slave pool somewhere. You know, without slaves. You know, we had to break labor unions. They had to break down the people. And they did. And so all they did, though, was postpone the unviability of that way of life, and they swept China into that destruction. And then China continued to destroy Tibet and its neighbors and things for a longer period, for another extra 20 years, actually. And maybe another 5 or 10 more. Who knows, you know. It might not be who will read my book or the equivalent, which is comes from Dalai Lama's own speeches. And he doesn't have to read this particular one, and change his mind and decide to enjoy life and by letting others enjoy it, you know. So we are very complicit, right? The famous Scowcroft mission, you know what it was, where he sent Scowcroft secretly during the Tiananmen saying, go ahead, clean your streets, as Henry Kissinger said on television at that time. You know, clean out those grubby students camping there, like quoting Martin Luther King and Gandhi, clean them out. We understand. There'll be a fuss in the Congress, but we'll understand. You'll get your, it's an inner revolution. You know, His Holiness once said to me, I think we might have been in Paris, but I can't remember, but we were in some city, and he said to me this one night, he said, well, you know, this is really too bad. This, like, rich-poor thing is getting really unbalanced. But 100 years ago it was too, and then they all rose up and revolted, and they took it all away from them, from the rich people. But then the new group was just as bad, even worse, because they hadn't even been brought up with at least some faint notion of noblesse oblige, of responsibility, you know. And which is funny for him to ask me or to rhetorically ask me, but of course I jumped and said, well, generosity. This time they should finally learn the lesson of history, awaken to the lesson of history, and start giving it away voluntarily, purposely. Not let them eat cake, but let them eat like organic whole wheat, multigrain, spelt food, and like bust Monsanto and stop destroying the crop base and everything, you know. And then he'd chuckle, yeah. And both of us shared the view that one does share emotionally that that's unrealistic to expect them to behave like that. Yeah, but that was before Buffett and Gates started their thing and whatever. There's some movement in that direction of some of these people, you know. But, you know, social entrepreneurial thing, spiritual capitalism, it's kind of, there's a movement. It still is not the main movement, unfortunately, but it's a big movement. And that has to happen this time around. We cannot go around through another round of bloody revolutions and then worse, Stalins and Lenins and Mao's getting in there. And mass killing of the most terrible kind, you know. We can't do that anymore. The planet won't support it. 21st century is new century, you know. Although, it's you know, 21st, the exact numbering from Jesus' time is not important, you know. It's the 1400 or something in the Muslims. It's 5,600 for the Jews. It's like 2,700 for the Buddhists. I mean, you know, it's we don't have to get hung up on the number from dear old Jesus, who Jack Harrick calls the Buddha of the West. No, we don't have to worry. We don't have to get into that. But now is the time when war no longer works and where everybody sort of can potentially know everything and therefore everybody has to be respected as a part of the whole. You know, there's no one who can be trashed, basically. If meditation doesn't work, try medication. Better and better Prozac. Although usually so far it's kind of bad side effects, you know. So meditation is better, really. You produce your own chemicals in your own body by calming yourself down. And this is where the inner science of India, both the yoga of the Hindus, yoga of the Taoists, also China to some extent, yoga of the Taoists and yoga, but the ultimate ur matrix of it is the Tendur, the yogas of the Buddhists, because they were the supreme inner scientists, of course, the supreme awakeners. And that's where it has to work. Although, and look at Eckhart Tolle, teaching 2 million people in 140 countries with the power of the great goddess, Oprah, on seminars on the internet. I mean, that is the dawn. That's the dawn, you know? You know what I mean? I mean, some people don't like him personally, and he apparently acts like a personality cult or something. He has charged you $300 to see him nowadays or some really crazy thing. Now that he's getting a lot of money, he's acting silly, or his organization is, I heard. But I don't care. I like the guy, and he's really based on Jesus, but he uses Buddha and Vipassana and mindfulness, and his big breakthrough personally was a Buddhist one, where, although the Christian mystics and psychologists had it too, because they are the same, but, you know, he was going to commit suicide talking himself into depression, and then suddenly he realized he was listening to himself, and the listener was different than the talker, and so the listener could say, well, shut up, I'm not going to kill myself, and I'm not going to be depressed. And that's like a basic Vipassana mindfulness insight. And, you know, he's delivering that now in whatever level of form people can get it to millions of people. And then he's one of many, you know, that will begin to. And Mopra herself had a shift. So that's the dawn of it. There it comes, you know. And that's essential. It isn't just like a frill or whatever. It comes, maybe people come into it because it's what we need now. I get all wound up about it. You know, I could get jealous of Eckhart Tolle. Oh, come on, Oprah, where's my book? Why aren't I up there? You know Uma. You know, I know. I met her. I was on her show, and the one show about the reincarnation from Seattle, but not from myself. Then somebody gave her in a revolution. Then the meat industry attacked her, and she didn't do books for 6 months. And then by that time, you know, it's too late. And so, and I can snivel and slobber about that, but. We're past that now. There's no point. Eckhart Tolle is doing the job. Good. Excellent. I really would prefer not to be on this book tour. I would really prefer to be back in Woodstock taking a break and, like, competing with Nina for the affection of the new white Pekingese puppy. You know, I'm in 60-something. And then there's some couple of translations I haven't finished that I think are very interesting and I'd like to finish, you know, just, you know, from Tibetan translating this and that. I don't really like demagoguing around. And, I mean, I kind of enjoy it, too, but it's tiresome, you know. And if someone else can do it, great. Let them do it. And I can sit and carp or send them some finer points if I think I have them. But it's all right that they do it, you know. So you can't just get wound up about it, you know. So there is that sense. And you know, I was thrilled. Actually, that same night when the first part of that seminar happened, and Nina knew about it, so she made me get off my desk and come and watch it. And at the same time, on a different channel, Deepak was trying to do Buddha. But it was kind of not as good, actually. Even though it was the name of Buddha, you know. And his sunglasses were not, he didn't need fashion consulting. He had like a pair of sunglasses that, forget about it. Eckhart Tolle, he could use like, I don't know, a little something, but his little beard and his little thing. But he's kind of cute. In his own way, and certainly he's unthreatening to Oprah, you know, and so she's able to have a shift with him. That's good. So that's the way it is. I'd like to see Dalai Lama on Oprah for 2 million people, 140 countries, but that's not happening, you know. But and maybe his diction and his accent wouldn't carry quite as well, you know. At least Eckhart Tolle, and Eckhart Tolle also naturally, reflexively, here and there refers to Jesus, and that's important for her audience. And that's great. I was thrilled, actually, recently. I've been reading Jack Kerouac, because I'm supposed to be writing this introduction, and he really gets the Buddha-Jesus connection in a great way, way ahead of Snyder and Watts and any of those guys. Fantastic. In the 50s. I don't know. Each one will have their own way of doing it. But, you know, if they're Christians and they meet Jesus, then Jesus will tell them that it's all right as long as they are loving. And that then they feel very happy, you know. And then whatever they choose to do with that feeling, they do, you know. And if they project it as that means, well, only after I die I'm going to go with Jesus, then that's the best they can do in this life, then that's it. If they meet Buddha in a similar way, then they'll have that experience there. If they meet Carl Sagan or Eckhart Tolle or Oprah or Uma or, you know, George Clooney, whoever it might be, who's their kind of archetype, and suddenly get a shift that, you know, well, you know, like Roosevelt said to many people, he said, the only thing to fear is fear itself. We've had the bad leadership that has said the only thing to do is be more afraid so that you won't realize I'm an idiot, you know, pushing them deeper into it, and the media also brainwashing them more deeper into it. And that's been very unfortunate in its effect, but I think the Obama phenomenon at this point indicates that people are sick of that, and they're ready to take a gamble, a lot of them at least. And I really don't think that the Republicans in any way expect McCain to possibly win, even if they attack Iran in September, which I think they plan to do, and therefore put everybody into a wartime thing, or maybe invite some kind of like disaster in the West Coast here or someplace. Maybe California would be the next shot for them. And even if they do, I don't think that they're going to get away with it, and they don't even expect to. But what they do expect is to hand the Democratic and Obama, or whoever it is, a complete mess, and then start blaming him for the mess. That's what they expect to do, and then they think they can come back with Jeb Bush maybe sometime in the future, maybe in 2012, which, as the Mayans tell us, will be the end of the world as we know it, and a major paradigm shift that everyone will be kind of forced to undergo by things like the Sichuan earthquake, you know, or actually that's the Tibetan earthquake. It's an earthquake in Tibet, actually. That's a Tibet Autonomous Prefecture of Sichuan is the majority of that area. And not just natural Sichuan, you know, Chinese Sichuan. So, yeah, we need that paradigm shift. And you can't say everybody's going to do one thing, you know. Different people are going to awaken in different ways. And a lot of people are going to get cancer from eating crappy hot dogs and drinking shitty water and eating genetically modified food. And then they're going to eventually get mad. And their relatives will get mad at Monsanto and, like, corned beef and whatever. I mean, it's going to happen in different ways, you know. And then they, after getting mad, they'll decide that they'll cheer up, and then they'll start eating good food, whatever, you know, feeding their children. Someone was telling me, last night, a nutritionist psychiatrist was telling me that there are some movements, even in America, especially in England, to get the food additives, coloring additives out of the children's food that is leading them into ADD and then into Ritalin and destroying the health of the whole generation of young kids. And that there's some movements in some states in the U.S. also to do that. I can see it in my grandchildren. It's completely, they're getting their brains ruined. Even, you know, some parents try their best, but then, you know, they have babysitters or they're busy, and then they see these things on television, these colored, weird Google things, and they eat them. And that's bad, really bad for them. So, you know, it's happening in all various ways. And there's no one answer to it, you know. There's no one answer to it. But I think the key thing about those who will do well, like a Transcendent Nation or other things, will be those that can kind of not hate the opposition, not be angry with it, embrace it, concede a little bit, compromise, conciliate, and come from that motivation of love, actually, and friendliness, kindliness. I think those will be successful. It's like the Dalai Lama is willing to give, you know, Tibet, you say, you know, to resurrect Tibet. But in a way, it doesn't need to be resurrected. Tibet is actually a free place. The Tibetans there are free. They're free in their minds and hearts as long as they don't get caught up in the rage and the anger and the terror, you know. And being free in their hearts then just realize it's itself naturally if they just stay that way. And the people who are wearing themselves out by being angry and beating and, you know, harming and whatever are going to just back off because they'll get sick of it, you know. So we don't really have to resurrect it in a way. We have to just not indulge in the perception of it as destroyed and perception of ourselves as despaired. I think that's key. Because despair does lead to violence. Thoreau said the mass of men today lead lives of quiet desperation in the 1830s. And then we had a century and a half of violence since then. Because that's where desperation leads to violence, right? You just lash out because what the hell, you know? You take the false promise of anger, that the weakness that you feel will be made up for by the rage, the power of rage, but that never will work. Rage will weaken you further. It's like addicting to alcohol or something, right? I don't the Christians. It's the Romans who taught them to be all focused on the crucified Christ. There was no worship of the crucifix until 285 of the Common Era and the Council of Nicaea. It was not an image for the early Christians. When they were actually being thrown to the lions, they were worshiping Christos Pedagogos, Christ the teacher, powerful, unintimidated person who was teaching people like, Sunday is every day, you know. Sabbath is every day. Don't give me a bunch of crap, you know. And let's heal some people right now. Do you know what I mean? That's what they worship. And the risen one, the one who couldn't be killed. But then Constantine, the Roman guy, to enforce the suppressiveness of the Roman Empire, he made them worship the destroyed one and put into the Western mind this idea that the good is always weak and the powerful is always bad and that you have to concede to the bad powerful, you know. And that we have to overcome that.
Weekly interstitial music provided by Tenzin Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more, visit tenzinchogyal.com. This podcast was brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House U.S. membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, please visit tibethouse.us. To learn about special intensive retreats and programs with Robert Thurman and friends at Menla, please visit menla.us, located just 2 hours north of New York City in the heart of the Catskills. Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. Please be sure to like and subscribe on iTunes and your favorite podcasting platform.